So far today, we've seen various descriptions in poetry and also in prose of the city of Hull, its surrounding areas, Holderness or the East Riding of Yorkshire. And I just want to dwell on those descriptions a little bit longer. And I want to think about how those understandings of the place, of the region, make themselves felt in the work of another two Hull poets, Peter Didsbury and Sean O'Brien. And I also want to think about the implications of how these two poets write about place and how they write about this place specifically. Now, what always strikes me, and Daniel mentioned this as well, is how similar these descriptions by the poets tend to be. You tend to get the same words and phrases recurring, and I don't think that's because the poets have small vocabularies. I think, you know, there's probably something else going on here. So for Larkin, you know, the key words and phrases would be things like on the edge, lonely, half turned towards distance and silence. For Dunn, the key words are things like marginal, provisional, backwater. Sean O'Brien, one of the poets that I'm talking about today, has said that Hull is a flat, forever provisional outpost of a vanished maritime empire. And I think it's interesting there that both Dunn and O'Brien are falling on this word provisional. They're both using the same word, as though this region is somehow constantly in this state of flux. It's never quite finished, it's never quite complete. And it never will be. And I think it's very easy to swallow these descriptions. After all, it's a geographical and it's a geological fact that this region is always changing. So you have the powerful tides of the River Humber, which are always shifting and they're very unpredictable. There's a kind of constant tussle between land and water going on in this region. And flooding seems to be becoming a kind of reality of life for people in Hull and the area. And then you've got the Holderness Coast, so the stretch of coast running from Flamborough in the north down to Spurn Point in the south. And this is the fastest eroding coastline in Europe. A good 2 meters of land is lost to the sea every single year. And since the Romans were living in Britain, more than 20 towns and villages have just been completely lost, wiped off the map. And eventually, Spurn Point, which I think is probably the most recognisable landmark on the East Coast, will just break off and wither away to nothing. So it's true that this is a place, this is a region, which is kind of forever provisional. It's in flux, it's subject to all of these changes taking place which are beyond its control. And then the city of Hull itself also seems to share this fate. Peter Barry, who's written a book about British poetry and cities, points out that cities are places of continual loss and change. And I think Hull really does exemplify this idea, this loss and change. Yes, the city may once have been very secure in its identity as one of the major fishing ports, but the decline of that industry clearly means that this is no longer true. And I would suggest that the place seems to have been suffering from a kind of identity crisis for a while. If it's not a major fishing port, then what is it? Is it a city of retail and leisure opportunities? Is it a provider of the nation's energy? Is it a cultural powerhouse, as the 2017 City of Culture status would suggest? Whatever the answer to these questions, I think this city, Hull, does experience a very complex relationship between the past and the present. And we've had years and years and years of urban degeneration, but then more recently, we've seen the beginning of regeneration with a new stadium and the St. Stephen's Shopping Centre and the Deep and all of these other things. And then elsewhere in the city, you have Hull's history kind of making itself felt in a number of ways. So Sean O'Brien might think of Hull as an outpost of a vanished maritime empire, but the maritime really still clings to the fabric of Hull. So if you go down the old mercantile high street, you have the university's Maritime Historical Studies Centre, which is located just metres away from abandoned docks. You have the old Queen's Dock, which in 1930 was filled in and became Queen's Gardens, as we know it today. The old Prince's Dock, which now has a shopping centre that almost seems to float above it, and that's been there since 1991. In the Old Town, you have numerous historical buildings, so former merchant banks and grand residences, which have been turned into cut-price pubs, but with listed status so as to kind of maintain the appearance of their former usage. And you have streets which contain pound shops and charity shops, but you only have to look up and you see ornate architectural details, or you see old-fashioned advertising boards. You've got the Humber Street area, which is very slowly being transformed, but never quite completely transformed, with those old, formerly derelict warehouses, which are now becoming cultural venues, cafes and restaurants. There's even a museum of nightclub culture down there. So not only is the region, sort of Holderness region, seemingly caught in this constant state of flux, the city of Hull, also has this very strange quality whereby the past is always present in the present. And I think Hull's poets really seem to have grasped those qualities, and it's this kind of thing that I want to look at today. So in 1982, this is the year that Douglas Dunn's A Rumoured City anthology comes out, Peter Didsbury, who's one of the poets featured in that anthology, publishes his first book of poems, The Butchers of Hull. And then the year after, in 1983, Sean O'Brien, who is also featured in A Rumoured City, he brings out his first book of poems, The Indoor Park. Now, neither of these poets were born in Hull, so they are incomers in a sense, but both of them grow up in the city. Peter Didsbury still lives in Hull today. They both appear on the national poetry scene in the early 1980s, so this is just as Larkin's muse has basically abandoned him. A few years later, Larkin will pass away. Douglas Dunn, yeah, he's just edited this anthology, but he's on the cusp of moving back to his native Scotland and rediscovering that particular identity. This is the context in which Didsbury and O'Brien are arriving on the national poetry scene. And they're also good friends. And one of the more wonderful connections, I think, between them can be found on the cover of Sean O'Brien's book there, The Indoor Park. Some of you might recognise this as the door leading into the reconstructed Victorian Conservatory in Pearson Park. This is the indoor park of the book's title. And the photograph was actually taken by, guess who, Peter Didsbury. Now, as modern poets, both of them seem to grasp this idea of shifting territories, which Joe Shapcott has written about, the quotes which Daniel was discussing earlier. This idea of shifting, of change as being the experience of modern life. Although when Shapcott writes about it, she's really talking about how people move around, how they move to different places, never tend to remain in the same place, they never tend to settle. Whereas I think for Didsbury and for O'Brien, this idea of shifting is more a case of experiencing the shifts and the changes which take place in one place, in a place where you might have settled at least for a period of time. In fact, I think it's worth just pausing to think about the cover of The Indoor Park for a moment, because there's something quite interesting about it. The door is slightly ajar, seems to be inviting us to go through, and I think it seems to suggest that by going through we'll kind of enter a new place, maybe even a new time. I mean, this is, after all, a reconstructed Victorian conservatory. And those plants, those quite exotic plants, seem to be yearning to get out and to kind of come and find us. So there's this very interesting, again, relationship between past and present, which you just get in this one photograph. And I think it's a really good introduction, a really good visual introduction to what we'll find in the poems in the book. In fact, Pearson Park itself is I think, a really great example of what I'm talking about here, this presence of the past in the present. So you have this reconstructed Victorian conservatory, you have these 19th century villas surrounding the park. You know, the park itself is a 19th century civic park. And Sean O'Brien seems to just get this. He seems to get this instinctually. He seems to be quite obsessed with this aspect of Hull and of Pearson Park specifically. And he seems to express it very vividly in his poems. O'Brien has said that all of his poetry stems from his experiences of place. And he says, beginning in the half-bombed Victorian streets of Hull in the 1950s, taking in its hidden gardens, parks, railways, and the vast presence of the Humber estuary. In fact, his sense of Hull and the surrounding area seems to manifest itself in two main ways. The first is the setting of his poems in transitional or maybe provisional, might be a better word, spaces. So railway stations, waiting rooms, ships, harbours, pubs, places that are kind of in between places where waiting tends to be done, not settling. And the other way that his attitude to the place seems to manifest itself is by the common presence of ghosts in his poems. And Station Song, one of the poems in the indoor park, has both of those things. As ever, all of the material, all the poems, the things that I talk about are on the lovely pastel pink handout. The pink was my choice, but also Philip Larkin's favourite colour. So there we are. You learn something new every day. So Station Song, which is on page 4 of the handout, I'll read the poem. "I should have seen you all the time, you ghosts, but I was taken up elsewhere with getting on, which got me here. I'm back for good. You are so patient, like the best of hosts. Am I your guest? The girl, is she one too? You say there's nothing I must do, that I am not accountable to you. You wish me nothing but the best. I try to see if I'll get lost. I walk the streets. But then a sign propped up on bricks explains what's mine. One door along this line of doors that open onto dust." So the narrator of this poem seems, his if it is a he, his mind seems to be elsewhere. He seems to have overlooked the presence of ghosts here, wherever here is, but seems to be fascinated by these ghosts, despite the fact that these ghosts helpfully inform him that he's not accountable to them, that they wish him nothing but the best. And yet his experience of the present, of the here and now, of this urban landscape which the poem is set in, seems to be a very uncomfortable and disorienting one. He walks the streets, and even though he comes across a sign explaining what's mine, all this is one door along this line of doors that open onto dust. So the present seems to be this very empty, dusty, ghostly space, and the narrator seems to have this obsession with ghosts and the past. He seems to be very unsure of his place in the here and the now, uncertain of what he's kind of allowed to do, or where he's allowed to go. And then the poem which follows this one in the indoor park, Le Départ, which is just next to it on the handout, this is another poem which sets up this difference between here and elsewhere. And again, the subject of this poem, the person, seems to be always caught between places, never really able to enjoy just being here now, wherever that is. I'll just read the first stanza of the poem. "You've been leaving for years, and now no one's surprised when you knock to come in from the weather. The crew is past embarrassment. They can live with their nautical names and with yours. So sit, take down your glass, and talk of all that is not you, that keeps you here among the sentimental stevedores, in the drinking clubs, in the dank afternoons of your 29th year. There may be news." So only 29 years old, the subject of this poem has to be told to sit down, to take down your glass and talk of all that's not you. And if we skip ahead to the final stanza, this person talks in his sleep. This talking in his sleep is a kind of sure sign of someone whose mind is in a different place to their body. And his partner, Yvonne, who seems very tired of this man's ability to just stay, she says, you talk in your sleep, so I woke you. All this travelling. Are we not always, always travelling? Let's drink to that and one before you go. So you have these poems in the indoor park which are to do with the difference between here and somewhere else. And I think these are interesting if you compare them to Larkin's poem Here, which Daniel talked about. Larkin's poem swoops into this landscape which is very recognizable as Hull and Holderness, and seems to just celebrate the fact of being here. It celebrates the experience of just being here in the moment right now. Whereas O'Brien's poems, the two poems that I've just read, feel very restless. Their narrators or their characters are very uneasy. They're always caught between places and times, never quite okay with where they are or what's going on. Now, the poem which follows Le Départ in the book is The Park by the Railway, again on the handout. This time, the poem opens with its narrator asking the question, where should we meet but in this shabby park? As though the meeting place for the two lovers of the poem is inevitable, a kind of foregone conclusion. And yet, once again, the place seems so uncertain of itself. The railings are missing, the sunsets are described as unimportant, the fair is half dismantled, it's a place of in-betweens, abandoned viaducts, lost mongrels, even the birdsong is said to be scratching at the soot of the last century, so it's as though the birdsong is trying to get back into the historical past. And in a station waiting room, so again we have another one of these transitional or provisional spaces, a waiting room, literally a place where you wait for something else to happen. Here, even the fireplace is confused. It's not quite convinced that there will be no more trains at the end of a summer that never began. And then finally, the poem ends with the acknowledgement that these two lovers, the two lovers featured in the poem, are living a funeral. They're not themselves, but they are the ghosts of us. So once again, the present is this very strange and ghostly place. It's very insecure. It's always harking back to history, to the past. And the blurb on the back of the cover of The Indoor Park tells us that this book's focus is, as we already know, Pearson Park in Hull. A paradigm, these are the words of the blurb, a paradigm of Victorian leisure and ambition. And that Victorian past specifically seems to be stronger, more vivid, more forceful than the present in which the poems are being written. So elsewhere in the book, there's a poem simply called Victorians. This is also on the handout. And the poem is set amongst white heads, white hats and garden chairs, enthusiasts of time, adulterous and hopeful men who met their fallen girls at stations out of town. And then the poem ends with a wish, let this be noon. Before the letter comes, the daughter coughs, the verses are exposed. Before the century goes black and you go blind and all the doors are closed. So the poem seems to wish for itself to be forever preserved in this kind of perfect Victorian noon. It can't seem to comprehend what comes after that. So the end of the Victorians is equated with going blind or with doors being closed. So again, Sean O'Brien's vision of Hull, writing in the early 1980s, seems very uncertain, and it allows for, or even desires, Hull's past, Hull's history, to bleed very forcefully into its present. Now, Peter Didsbury's vision of Hull can often seem much more rooted in the contemporary, in the here and now, than his friends. His poem, The Library Steps, contains references, although they're not explicit references, to Hull Central Library, to Pearson Park, and to the Polar Bear Pub on Springbank. Another of his poems, The Pierhead, mentions the rivers Hull and Humber, and again indirectly alludes to the Minerva Pub, and then acts as a kind of elegy for the ferries which used to cross the river, but which aren't there anymore. So another example of that continual loss and change which Peter Barry writes about. In another poem from The Butchers of Hull, A Daft Place, the poem heads south from here to the river in a kind of panoramic scoop, which is similar to the one we see in Larkin's poem here. And we take in the estate, suburbs, the ruined town, domestic architecture, the river mud, gulls on the dustbin, and the unignorable presence of the estuary. The estuary, again, always seems to make itself felt in the work of poets of Hull. But really, Didsbury's poetry is no more fixed in the here and now of Hull and Holderness than O'Brien's is. In a poem called The Drainage, quite a long poem which is on the handout, there's a similar imaginative movement from the present to the past, or rather a kind of bringing of the past into the present, which we've seen happen a lot in O'Brien's work. So the poem opens with the line, "When he got out of bed, the world had changed." And although some features of a relatively modern age do remain, so the window panes and the bounds of a large parish, the setting has changed beyond recognition. So this man gets out of bed and he stepped outside, not into his street, but a flat, wet landscape, sluices, ditches, drains, frozen mud and leaf cake, dikes. He found he knew the names of them all. He was naked, he had to clothe himself. The heifers stood like statues in the fields. They didn't moan when he sliced the hides from them. So this man, in other words, seems to have been transported back to a primitive or a prehistoric time and space, one where he has to hunt for his own food, for his own shelter, for his own clothing. But this flat, wet landscape, which is described with its sluices, ditches, drains, dikes, is again recognisably that of the Holderness region. And I think this imaginative transformation in terms of time and place, which happens in the poem, could be explained by the very transformations constantly taking place in this region. That those geographical ones which I was talking about earlier. And it's worth noting that Didsbury, as well as being a poet, is also an archaeologist. So he's particularly qualified, in a way, to notice these changes, to be able to see the presence of the past in the present. This is what archaeologists do, essentially. His work, like O'Brien's, is not very often able to simply take place in the contemporary, always or almost always seems to allow for the past to seep back in to make itself felt. And like O'Brien, Didsbury appears to have a very strong sense of the region's ever-changing nature, its ever-changing character. So in other poems by Didsbury, we have images of butcher's shops as being like Catholic shrines, or we have swans from the lake in Pearson Park flying out of the Stone Age, or in The Pierhead, a poem which I've mentioned, Byron swimming across the Humber rather than the Dardanelles. Now these imaginative flights of fancy are remarkable and they're stunning to read, I think, but they do pose an issue, or at least a question, which I think is worth considering, which is this: that reading all of these poetic responses to Hull and Holderness, I think it would be very easy to forget that anyone actually lives here, or at least easy to believe that the only inhabitants are ghosts and ghostly figures, so the ghosts of Victorians or prehistoric men, or that the people are always kind of looking elsewhere, so they're looking across the sea, they're maybe looking to exotic places, or they're always looking to the past. When the reality is that, you know, 350,000 people live in Hull and in Holderness today. And I would suggest that they kind of don't spend all of their days preoccupied with the Victorian past or with other places. They're probably for most of the time busily engaged with getting on with the here and now of everyday existence. So in that sense, they're kind of more like the crowds in Larkin's poem here than the ghosts and the traces of the past which we see so often in poems by O'Brien and Didsbury. Now, I'm being deliberately harsh to these poets here, and I should say that I love their work and I love reading their work, and I'm being kind of deliberately awkward, but and that's partly because, you know, there's no rule which says that poets have to deal with the real or that they have to deal with the contemporary, the here and the now, and indeed, really all O'Brien and Didsbury are doing is what many contemporary poets all over the place have been doing, which is refusing to be tied to reality, whatever that means. But at the same time, I think it's okay to ask whether we feel that something might perhaps be lacking in their work in terms of those people living in the region right now. Daniel's talked about Douglas Dunn's poems about some of those people, so the people who were living on Terry Street in the 1960s. And yes, we might feel critical, perhaps, about Dunn's representation of those people or his response to those people, but at least his work recognises their existence and recognises the here and now of their lives. So the questions I want to ask and kind of leave to linger as we go into the break, and maybe we can discuss these things after the break, is does the work of these later poets, Didsbury and O'Brien, you know, really successfully evoke the character of place at the expense, perhaps, of evoking the people who live in that place? And essentially, this is a question which ties into the bigger question already posed by Daniel today, which is what the poetry and the poets of Hull actually mean to the people of Hull. And I think I'll conclude there, and I'll leave those questions to percolate and linger, and hopefully we can discuss some of these questions and issues after the break. But thank you very much for listening.